Amongst the many virtues of being a parent, I have a 5-year-old at the moment, and it means that we've just hit that age where I'm being incessantly asked questions about things. And the favourite category of question is definitions. Why is this this and not that? Why is this called this and not that? And I have to say, I'm so often at my wit's end. Often at my wit's end in the garden as well. You may be out in the garden this weekend and you may be looking around and deciding the parts of your garden bed that should be nourished and loved and the ones that should be discarded, possibly in a peak of anger. Our next guest is going to question your attitude about some of those things. John Dwyer is a horticulturalist. He says it's time to rethink our relationship with the dreaded weed. John's a former lawyer turned plants man, and he's done a PhD about weeds that he's currently turning into a book. John, thanks so much for joining us on RN.
A pleasure.
Now, just to begin with, what's the botanical definition of a weed?
Well, there isn't really a botanical definition because weed is not a botanical category. Weed's a human category. It's a way in which we describe how we feel about a plant.
So absolutely no botanical basis in it at all?
No. Any plant, it's often said, can be a weed. And that means, I think as a matter of logic, that what makes it a weed lies outside the plant.
So leaving aside the question of subjectivity for a minute, because I think that's something that we're going to have to come back to, how much of it's about physical context? Wrong plant, wrong place?
Oh, very much, yes. One of the definitions of weed is a plant growing where it is not wanted, or a plant out of place. A plant may be valued in one place and a weed in another.
Before we drill deeper down into this, I just have to ask, in terms of the shift from the law to horticulture, which I find a fascinating one, what made you make that shift?
As I was coming to what I saw as being the end of my working life as a lawyer, I started a general course in horticulture at Burnley, and I found the subjects that I studied there, weeds, were the fascinating one because there were so many unanswered questions about weed. And the more I probed, the more I found that there were no answers to many of the questions, and that intrigued me and has led me to the study of weeds ever since.
This question of category and definition of whether something is good or bad, it seems that move from the law to horticulture, it doesn't surprise me that you might have fixated on the part of horticulture that was about writing things off that shouldn't be written off. Is that too big a leap?
Perhaps not, no. The law is all about distinctions, definitions. Is this a case of that, or should we pin it up under some other category? So there is, I think, some sort of affinity between my past as a lawyer and my present as a scholar of weeds. Indeed, my PhD supervisor, Greg Moore, said that at times it looked as if what I was doing was cross-examining the authorities as I wrote about weeds.
I love it. A scholar of weeds is magnificent. I'm interested, even if there's no botanical or scientific basis, we, in our kind of official discourse, we use the language of weeds a lot. There's a National Weed Register, for example.
Yes.
It's clearly quite an important thing for botanical and horticultural practice to identify plants that are destructive to a natural environment.
Yes. It's the great paradox of weeds that while on the one hand they are this hard to define fluid category from which plants can come and go, on the other hand we have weed lists. People started making weed lists in the 19th century, and in a way weed lists can often be misleading because people tend to look and say, is the plant on the weed list? If it is, let's get rid of it, without going really into the circumstances of that particular plant in that particular situation.
Can you give us some examples of particular plants that have made their way off the weed list, have been singled out in this McCarthyist style and then kind of afterwards told, no, you're okay, you're a good, redeemed member of society?
The famous example is rye, from which rye bread comes. Rye started life, it's generally agreed, as a weed of wheat and barley crops. And then slowly, in particular as agriculture moved north into climates that were more and more hostile to wheat, it was found that the rye did rather better. And so in the end, rye became a crop on its own. It's the usefulness of a plant to humans that often will decide whether or not they want to call it a weed.
John, I'm loving your benevolence to weeds here, but I'm going to have to go hard-hitting because There are definitely plants that are invasive, that are damaging to local flora and fauna, that are introduced unwisely and spread virulently.
Of course. And blackberry is the example that everybody knows about. Encouraged by von Müller, it's said that when he was on his walks in the bush, he used to sow seeds of blackberry in the ashes of his fire where he'd cooked his billy. He believed that the blackberry deserved to be on every mountain glade. And look at what's happened with the blackberry today. It's a curse. The prickly pear is another one. Introduced to Australia on the first fleet because Sir Joseph Banks thought it would be good to be able to have the cochineal beetle in Australia to provide a secure source of the dye for the redcoats of the soldiers. And look what happened to prickly pear. It ran wild in New South Wales and Queensland.
There are other weeds, of course, that aren't so damaging, though, aren't there?
Yes.
What should we think of them? What should we make of those?
Well, I think one needs to attend to where the weed is and what are the circumstances in which it's growing. For example, it's often complained that some plants have tended to escape from their garden settings and to grow on roadsides. Well, my attitude to that is that one shouldn't say, well, because it's growing on a roadside, it's a weed. I should rather say, as this is a plant that we thought was good to grow in our gardens, shouldn't we be pleased if it's naturalised and is growing by the side of the road?
I'm interested, John, because I do think that there are going to be some avid gardeners out there listening who are very angry at what you've got to say right now, because they have an intensely emotional response when it comes to the problem of weeds in their garden. Why do you think emotion rules our response to the world of weeds?
In a way, it's a puzzle as to why emotions are so much involved, but that they are involved is clear, I think. It's partly because of the language that we tend to use when we're talking about weeds, when we call them noxious or feral. I think that the use of such language tends to colour our thinking and to reinforce the negative feelings that we may have about weeds.
And we, of course, talk about eradicating them. We talk about weed killer. I mean, the language is not just about removal, it's about annihilation. Do you think that's a bit extreme?
I think that the aim or the desire to eradicate weeds is often futile. I once did a time study, what they call, in accounting terms, an aged inventory of the noxious weeds of Victoria. And there are plants that have been on the noxious weeds list for 150 years, and they are still here. There are plants that have been on the noxious weed list for a shorter time, just 100 years, and they're still here. I don't know of any case where a plant that was on the noxious weed list has been successfully eradicated once it has established itself.
So there's nothing to be done?
Before people turned to herbicides, farmers knew how to manage weeds on their farms by cultural rotation, let a field lie fallow, plough in the weeds that have grown there to fertilise it for the next crop or for the pasture grasses that they're going to sow. We need to get back to good husbandry in relation to weeds rather than the use of herbicides.
John, I'm mostly convinced by what you have to say, but then I still remember kind of looking out to my backyard and seeing the passion fruit vine choking everything else, or the nasty little creepy crawly thing that I have no idea what it is.
Yes.
And the emotions creep back. It's hard not to see the weed as a kind of symbol of colonial forces coming in and taking over a land that they don't fully understand.
Yes, it's the fact that they're not under our control that really upsets us. When we have a garden, we like to say that it's ours to decide what will grow in it and what will not.
So in that vein, do you put your prickly pear where your mouth is? Are there weeds that you leave unchecked in your garden?
Indeed, there have been weeds that I've left unchecked, yes. Nicotinia is one. We've had some nicotinia plants mysteriously grow in our garden, popping up here and there. If it's in a suitable spot, I'll leave it there.
John Dwyer, appearing for the defence in the case of the Crown versus the weed. A lawyer turned horticulturalist. John, you've made me think about how to learn to live with my weeds. Thanks so much for joining us today.
A pleasure.
John takes a justice-for-all approach to plants, even the ones we fear and despise. If you take issue with anything John said today, feel free to give us a comment on the Facebook page or on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website. Or, if you agree completely, rise up with John and defend weeds as one. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams.